actually need two hockey sticks here, right? Because I'm a left shot, the wrong stick, right? These things matter to Canadians, right? So, and to Russians, to Russians as well. So, okay. So I am going to give some very general point about neutrinoless double beta decay, with the aim to try to describe what it is that we need to reach down to milli-EV sensitivity, which is the region of parameter space for which neutrinoless double beta decay would be allowed if the mass hierarchy is the normal hierarchy. And so my talk will give a very brief introduction to neutrinoless double beta decay, because I'm assuming that everybody here is already quite familiar with it. And then I will talk about different isotopes for a little bit, and I'll give a case study for trying to reach a normal hierarchy for double beta decay, which is with tellurium-loaded liquid scintillator, presenting some new ideas for background rejection. And I'll begin. All right, so neutrino mass. If we're thinking about physics beyond the standard model, we know there is physics beyond the standard model. It's neutrino mass. The second most important evidence for physics beyond the standard model is non-baryonic cold dark matter. But neutrino mass is important, and so we have to write down the term, the mass term, in the standard model Lagrangian. There's two ways we could write it, or perhaps you're both there. So when we write it this way, the Majorana neutrino mass term is precisely the term in the Lagrangian that's responsible for this process, which is double beta decay with no neutrino emission. Okay, so then that's it right there. And so this one slide encapsulates everything there is that you need to know about the rate for neutrinoless double beta decay. It proceeds if and only if neutrinos are Majorana fermions, in which case the neutrino and the antineutrino are not distinguished. So there's the process repeated from the previous slide. There is this chirality mismatch, where right-handed has to turn into left-handed, and that's what introduces the component M over E that goes into the amplitude. And the electron component in the neutrino mixing matrix are these matrix elements, U, E, I, and this is a complex valued sum. So there's the possibility that you have cancellations because of these phases, but this is the amplitude here, and then therefore the decay rate for neutrinoless double beta decay goes as the square of this quantity here we call M beta beta. Okay, so that's the Majorana neutrino effective mass for double beta decay. And this is the plot coming from the Review of Particle Physics article or entry in the in 2013, updated from the study originally from 2008. We put in what we know about the mass splittings from the oscillation experiments, and you get these colorful bands here that I tried to explain in here, but you don't have to pay attention to that. These are the whatever's in color is potentially allowed for producing a neutrinoless double beta decay signal. On the x-axis is the mass of the lightest neutrino mass state, and this is m beta beta here on the y-axis. And so then, if you're up here, this is we can call quasi-degenerate, where the mass splittings are small compared to the masses of the neutrinos. And then here, if it's an inverted mass hierarchy, then it would suggest double beta decay strength that is large compared to down here, the normal mass hierarchy. So as I was describing in the previous slide, if it goes as mass m beta beta squared, the rate, then it gets progressively harder and harder to probe down to this level. So these aren't necessarily universally representative, but just to give you a sense of scale, that at the scale of the experiments, like the Heidelberg-Moscow experiment, the 10 kilogram scale, you're sort of exploring M beta beta up here. Experiments at 100 kilogram scale, say like XO200, you're exploring here, and experiments at the ton scale get you sensitivity into this inverted hierarchy parameter space, and so then going however many more decades in order to start to probe here, that's the parameter space that we want to try to reach. We're trying to figure out how can we reach this, and then that's the question, how do we get out to here? Okay, so this is my talk then. For ultimate neutrinoless double beta decay sensitivity, you need large mass, so large number of nuclei of the candidate doublet isotope that is efficiently deployed slash instrumented in your detector, and you need extremely low background. So you need large signal, low background. That's it. Any questions? That's it. So in order to push down, you need to make progress on both fronts, large mass and low backgrounds, and that's what we'll try to look at in the next few slides. But that's really about it. Okay, so in pushing backgrounds lower, with the goal being to reach down to the parameter space that's suggested by the neutrino mass, the normal neutrino mass hierarchy, then here are some ways you can do it. So I'll remind people what the neutrinoless double beta decay signal looks like. So when you have the normal standard model double beta decay with two neutrino emission, you get this spectrum. This is the sum of the electron energies, the sum of the energies of the emitted electrons. So you get this sort of continuum here. And then if there's no neutrinos that carry off momentum and energy, then the sum gives you a peak at the end point with the recoiling nucleus taking up the momentum. And then there's always this blow up that shows that this two neutrino double beta decay rate is actually much, much higher than the expectation for the zero nu peak. So ways that you can distinguish this signal, the neutrinoless double beta decay signal, from backgrounds are the following. You can think about, can I improve energy resolution by making that region of interest narrower and narrower? So that's pretty difficult to do. But what else? But depends on the experiment. If you're already an experiment with very good energy resolution, then thinking about how am I going to improve that is quite a substantial challenge. If you're an experiment with, say, not so good energy resolution, certainly it pays off to work on this as well as on all of the other factors for pushing the background lower. So what else distinguishes this signal? There are two betas, two electrons that are emitted. So if you have event topology, we can see that there were two electron tracks produced in that event that gave energy at the endpoint. Then that's a very powerful background rejection to identify the beta-beta track. And so you'll advertising Alvaro's talk, which we'll hear about next. But when we think about event topology for background rejection, I think it also includes different ideas about event topology depending on the type of backgrounds you have. So some experiments, like Quore, for example, have alpha backgrounds on the surface. And so having beta-alpha discrimination in their cryogenic bolometers is important, and one can consider that as background rejection based on event topology. Some experiments exploit single-site, multi-site, where gamma is scattering multiple times inside of a germanium crystal or inside of a liquid xenon TPC, deposit energy multiple sites compared to the single-site energy deposition from double beta decay. Some experiments have gamma backgrounds, all experiments have gamma backgrounds, and you want to distinguish betas from gammas if you can do that. So this whole category here, I would say, is one where there's a lot of interesting ideas, and we'll be hearing about one from Alvaro, and I'll talk a little bit about this towards the end of this talk. Always, you have to improve the radio purity of your detector, get backgrounds lower, shielding. That's something everybody works on. And then there's always this idea that if you can tag the daughter following the double beta decay and identify that it happened, that it gives you powerful background rejection. So those are ideas for pushing the backgrounds lower. So before I get into backgrounds, let's just look at this first point. Okay? So we have to get the size of these experiments up to the scale where we can attack in normal mass hierarchy, m beta beta down at the milli electron volt level. Okay, so there are 35 naturally occurring isotopes that can double beta decay. And I'm going to list only those ones with Q value greater than 2 MeV ranked here on this list by the Q value. And so we have some usual suspects for the double beta experiments like tellurium, xenon, germanium, selenium. But there are experiments that have tried to use many of these isotopes in the past. They have different Q values, and the higher the Q value, the more advantageous in terms of both this phase space as well as being higher energies above background radiation. But the natural abundance of these isotopes in the respective elements range from very low values to very high value for tellurium. Okay, so let's do the calculation. And these numbers come from sort of the study from Steve Biller and I've edited it to sort of update it a little bit. We worked on this together when I was on sabbatical in Oxford some years ago now. Okay, so here's the calculation. We want, let's say, m beta beta at the 2.5 milli electron volt level. Okay, so then given each of these isotopes with a calculable phase space and a nuclear matrix element, and for this neutrino mass, we want to figure out how many tons of that isotope, of the pure isotope, do we need in order to get one event per year. This is just to give you a feel. So then it's in the, of the order of several tens of tons of the isotope. Okay? And then this column here shows, based on the natural abundance, what's the equivalent natural tonnage you need of that element. And here's the cost, okay, where the cost comes from searching on the internet to find out what the cost is for the bulk element. Okay, so there are some elements, like calcium, superabundant. Calcium is top five most abundant elements on Earth. Superabundant, but the natural abundance of the isotope double beta decays is small, so you require 16 kilotons of the calcium in order to have the rate to see any kind of double beta decay at milli-electron volt level. Although calcium being abundant is cheap, so actually getting this much calcium is not a problem, but putting this into your detector, sort of not so good. Other elements, like palladium, is a semi-precious metal. For this much natural palladium, you don't have to worry about isotope enrichment, but it's $5 billion worth, okay? Just to get that much palladium. Okay, so let's digest this table for a minute. On the next two slides. All right, so for enriched isotope, here's the observation. That the mass of the enriched isotope that you need is within a factor of few the same for all of the candidates, okay? So some tens of tons of the isotope is needed. And then that's not so surprising, because sometimes you've heard it said that there's not one double beta isotope that's better than another after you do the calculation where you compare the phase space nuclear matrix element, also the mass and the number of nuclei, basically the A, right? So if you have a certain mass, how many nuclei you have to divide by A. So when you do the calculation, they all come in within a factor of a few, which is the spread in the nuclear matrix elements calculation, perhaps also, but so then, they're roughly equivalent. So, but then the next point to note is that enriching any isotope is costly, if the technology exists at all for that enrichment of that element, of that isotope. Right, so if there's potentially the push to go to the normal mass hierarchy for neutrinoless double beta decay, maybe future tech development should be in this direction, figuring out how you can cheaply enrich one or several of these isotopes, so that then producing tens of tons of that isotope can be done economically. Let me just talk about the scale-up that's needed. So there are several experiments that have deployed large amount of enriched isotope. And I'm going to compare what's needed for the normal hierarchy, like what's on this column, to what the largest amount of enriched isotope that have been deployed in several of these experiments. So for example, CAM-LAN-ZEN has the most enriched xenon, has more than XO200. But the amount of xenon you need compared to what CAM-LAN-ZEN already has is a factor 135 more in order to reach. And then NEXO is proposed to have 5 tons of enriched xenon. It's only a factor of 10 more you need in order to reach that level. It's on the previous slide. For germanium, it's a factor 300 over LEGEND, which is the combination itself, a scale-up combination of Gerda and Majorana, but they're in the process of enriching new germanium right now. And so that's what you need. For selenium, a factor of 200 over what the current plan is for SuperNemo to deploy enriched selenium. SuperNemo itself is currently in the demonstrator phase. Okay. So in all these cases, the substantial scale-up is required for the isotope. Isotope enriching is expensive. And no matter what you do, you have to be able to make a detector out of your desired material.
How far is core?
Core is not enriched, though.
Yeah.
So I'll mention it perhaps on the slide after. Okay. So key points about natural element. Oh, yes, Alfred.
What about the black fraction of this isotope that is wasted by fiducialization?
Yeah.
Say xenon, like, could be, you could have 1 ton or 5 tons, but considering your fiducial effective one is really 1 ton.
That's right. So I didn't include it on this previous slide. On this next one, I do include it when I talk about SNOPLUS. Yeah, I can take the hit myself on that point. All right, so for natural element then, isotope enrichment could actually be a limiting case because the technology doesn't exist to enrich calcium or neodymium to the levels that you need economically. But using natural element, you sometimes end up with either outlandish quantities and or outlandish costs, as shown here. And so some of the ones that are interesting are the tellurium case is interesting because the natural isotopic abundance of the double beta element is high, 34%. So this is how much tellurium you need, natural tellurium you would need, in order to get a double beta rate that would be one event per year for normal mass hierarchy type milli-electron volt neutrino mass. And some of these are cheap. I try to figure out why cadmium is particularly cheap, but it is. Calcium is, but then you have this crazy. So I think some of the interesting ones could include tellurium, cadmium, selenium, molybdenum, sort of zirconium, sort of tin. And so they're listed here. But anyway, I've run the course here. I'm not going to go on and bore you about economics anymore. Okay. I've done it, so I won't talk anymore about feasibility, just to point out that this is a substantial scale up that's needed just to get the rate, just to get the signal you need. And then we'll look at the backgrounds. Okay. So let's talk about the scale factor between current experiments with large masses of natural isotope compared to what's needed for normal hierarchy. So SNOPLUS I'm using for the tellurium case, not Quarry. Quarry has 200 some kilograms of tellurium-130 deployed as 700 kilograms of tellurium oxide crystals, something like that. SNOPLUS has 3.9 tons of natural tellurium that's going to be deployed in the detector, although only 0.77 tons is in the fissionable volume, Alvaro's point. So the scale-up factor needed for SNOPLUS to go to normal hierarchy levels of signal, detecting that efficiently and making your detector work and everything is, of course, part of the challenge. You have to make your detector. But that's a scale factor of 17 to 90, just in comparison to these sorts of scale factors. So just showing you that we're not so far off in this particular case. And then that's the reason why I'm going to make this a case study for how we get to the normal mass hierarchy with an experiment. It's feasible to consider for all the cases. So here's where we are in my talk. How much time have I chewed up already? Oh, I'm on 10 here. So I'll go through tellurium-loaded scintillator as a case study, and then I'll share some new ideas about background rejection with you. Very, very new. They're not like published anywhere. Maybe these ideas are, you know, belong in the crazy part of the discussion, but it'll be fun. So here's what we know about double beta K experiments. Again, only if you can see these shaded bands here. So the current experiments that are reported in the current generation of experiments, Camel and Zanexo, Gerda, soon we'll hear a result from Quarry next week. They've probed down to here, excluding this space up here for neutrinoless double beta decay. SNOPLUS, when we run with the first incarnation of SNOPLUS, with that 3.9 tons of tellurium deployed, we get down to here, where this band shows the uncertainty nuclear matrix element, but we start to touch the inverted hierarchy. When we consider a SNOPLUS phase two, where we add even more tellurium, we get down to here. But still, we want to get down to cover, at least touch this region and start to probe substantially this region here. So that's just to remind you where we are, what we think we can do with tellurium-loaded scintillator. These are the limits coming from cosmology for the sum of neutrino masses as interpreted on this plot. All right, so coming from this NSAC meeting in the US in 2014, these are just some comments that were made by the community. What would constitute an ideal neutrino-less double beta decay experiment? Capabilities are desirable. And my commentary is here. Of course, you want very low backgrounds, internal and external. You want very good energy resolution, also calibration, scalability, meaning it has to be acceptable for cost. Tracking of betas to identify the beta-beta event topology is very desirable. Large Q values, desirable, again, to be above backgrounds and for larger space. Ability to remove or replace the isotope, so you can demonstrate a possible signal by taking it out, putting it back in. And then, so a tellurium-loaded liquid scintillator approach, like SNOPLUS, does the ones in blue very well. and doesn't do this at all. Doesn't do so well there. It's a moderately good Q value. Okay. So then as a reminder, I'm putting up this slide here to show you that with fluorine-loaded scintillator, which has poor energy resolution, there is mileage to be made by improving the energy resolution. Right? SNO Plus is using 1990s era photomultiplier tubes from SNO. Right? So we already have high QE tubes. One can envision in future incarnation of this experiment to pack in the photomultiplier tubes, much like the Juno neutrino experiment is aiming to boost the light yield by factors of 3 in the liquid scintillator experiment. So there's mileage you can make here. For topology, I'm going to talk about that next. Radio purity, of course, we're always working on radio purity, how to reduce backgrounds. And so then here's the background pie chart showing what are the backgrounds in SNO Plus double beta decay. And they include boron and solar neutrinos as a dominant background. Just the neutrino electron scattering, depositing energy in the region of interest for double beta decay. The two neutrino double beta tail, internal backgrounds, external surface cosmogenic. So then how do you reduce these backgrounds? So for the two neutrino double beta, you can reduce that with energy resolution. Okay. For these sort of external backgrounds and surface from shielding and background cuts, from internal backgrounds, from purification, background cuts, cosmogenic backgrounds from purification and also waiting for some of them to decay, putting the tellurium underground and letting it cool like we're doing. For the boronate solar neutrinos, how do you reduce the neutrino background in your double beta decay experiment? If you can concentrate the tellurium into a smaller volume, you get less boronate solar neutrinos and making your deployment more effective, more efficient, also helping this fiducial volume question. Also helps to trim this background down. So let me give you some new ideas then for this background rejection. So one, maybe the only other way other than trying to concentrate your tellurium in a smaller volume to get smaller solar neutrino background is Trenkov scintillation separation. Okay, so in your liquid scintillator, your charged particles are producing both Trenkov light and scintillation light. Scintillation light is 50 times more intense than the Trenkov light. Okay, so if you can pick out, however, the directional Cherenkov light that's produced amidst the much more abundant isotropic scintillation light, if you can pick that out, then you can correlate it, that Cherenkov signal, to the direction of the sun, and then any event that you see that's a possible candidate in your region of interest, if it's correlated with the direction of the sun, you can cut that, okay? Providing a way to reduce the boronate solar neutrinos. So that's worth pursuing, and there's some R&D efforts on doing this, not just within SNO Plus. Actually, we probably should work a little bit more on this, I think, but other experimentalists are looking at this question too. There's another use for Trenkov scintillation separation that I'll describe here. I don't know if there's a name for it, so I came up with this name, and it's the Trenkov scintillation deficit, which you could possibly use for beta-gamma separation. So let me explain this to you here. So you have a solar neutrino, okay? Scatters an electron, and that electron deposits energy around the endpoint for double beta, okay? So this electron is in your detector losing energy, emitting scintillation light and Trenkov light, scintillation light, Trenkov light, until the electron drops below the Trenkov threshold, it's not emitting Trenkov anymore, and you get scintillation light. So you have, you can measure the Trenkov and scintillation light, that's characteristic, okay? You have a double beta decay event. Okay, you have two electrons now. The sum of their energy equals the same value as at the endpoint. Now you have two electrons that are scintillating and Cherenking, emitting Cherenkov light, and they're losing energy, Cherenkov scintillation, Cherenkov scintillation, until they both drop below, in respectively, Cherenkov threshold. So the scintillation Cherenkov deficit is greater in that case. You have a gamma ray, deposits energy in the region of interest. It makes a bunch of Compton electrons. All of those electrons losing energy, scintillation, Cherenkov, Cherenkov. So they all drop below the Cherenkov threshold. The Cherenkov deficit's even greater, and which is we've known for years for SNO, that when you calibrate with a gamma source, you get a different amount of Cherenkov light than if you have an electron source. But if you can measure this by picking out the Cherenkov light, you now can discriminate, say, the boronate solar neutrinos background from a double beta decay, possibly from gammas. So these are event topology type things that can be exploited, developed, for tellurium liquid scintillator. Experimentally, different ideas include You can use a weak scintillator, like Mini Boon has scintillation in Cherenkov light. But that's a bad idea because you lose the scintillation light which you need for the energy resolution. You can think about a slow scintillator where you delay the scintillation light so the Cherenkov light is prompt. You can pick them out more easily. Improving light detection you already want to do with higher quantum efficiency PMTs and faster, but the Cherenkov light is prompt, so faster PMTs lets you look for that spike at the short times with Cherenkov light. Increased pixelization of the readout is something that my undergrad student and I have been studying that we'll soon write a paper about too. That obviously works, right? It's just that you spread out the scintillation light and it's isotropic, so if you have higher number of pixels, the occupancy is lower, so then the Cherenkov ring stands out, even if it's much weaker than the scintillation light. So in Steve Biller's normal hierarchy paper, we'll call it, this idea is already included in the projections. Let me describe this plot here. It's not really easy to figure out what this plot is doing here, but okay, this is how big your detector is going to be. This is in a tellurium-loaded liquid scintillator. This is how much tellurium isotope you need in order to be able to reach this normal hierarchy 2.5 milli electron volt sensitivity. Okay, and so then this is the mass of the tellurium you need in tons, which is also roughly the cost in millions of dollars. Okay, so at the few hundred million dollar level, it's not crazy, not feasible in terms of cost, right? You're over $1 billion, it's starting to really push it. But all right, so then if this is the amount of tellurium versus the detector fiducial volume, then steep slopes represent high loading fractions, and then shallow slopes represent small fractions, right? So for a given amount of tellurium, you can either have it concentrated or more dilute. And so then these curves represent light yield. 1,000 PE per MeV is more light yield than we project we'll collect in SNOW Plus, version one. I think I have another 2 minutes here terms of finishing. But with high QE tubes, we might already be there. Juno is aiming for 1,200 PE per MeV. You can think about these levels. And so the more light yield you have, the less tellurium you need in order to reach this. And then going from the solid to the dashed is when you include the solar neutrino suppression by the still-to-be-developed Cherenkov identification that rejects that background. So then we're talking about these sort of dash curves. If you can develop that technology, depending on what light yield you achieve, really, really good, already very good, somewhere like that. This will tell you how much tellurium you would need to load and the cost and what kind of fiducial volume you need to make. So none of these numbers are actually really all that scary, right? Kilotons, and this is like Juno. That's like super K. These costs all less than collider experiments, right? All right, one more crazy idea, okay? The daughter tagging. So people have heard a lot about xenon experiments like EXO, now also the next collaboration talk about trying to tag the barium. Xenon 136 decays to barium, and there's talk of using barium tagging, which is really techniques borrowed from, not borrowed, techniques from the AMO field. To do single atom identification. But then the challenge includes how you drift the barium ion in your large liquid or gas TPC volume, okay? All right, let's think about tellurium. Okay, tellurium double beta decays, and the daughter is xenon, okay? So are there techniques for single atom xenon detection? There's a big xenon community that know how to make xenon detectors, and then the question is there xenon AMO field techniques that we can use to single atom identify xenon. But in a tellurium-loaded liquid scintillator, can we drift the xenon daughters and collect them? The answer is yes, I know how to do that. It's a liquid scintillator, I can do that with a pump, right? I just circulate the liquid and I could drift that xenon. If I can collect it and figure out how to single atom detect it, I have daughter tagging in my tellurium liquid scintillator. So my summary, can we get to MeV sensitivity for neutrinos double beta decay? We're working on it. Okay, thanks.
So we're a bit over time, but let's have one question.
So even if you detect the particle on the circulating liquid, how would you describe the
Right, so you have to reconstruct the event. So if you see a double beta decay, reconstruct the event, determine its energy, try to determine its characteristics, you can see that it's a double beta on the back. You have to drift this, imagine, like collecting the liquid, and then know that you've drifted and collected that atom from that small. If you can do that, then helps you from the normal and not have backgrounds. So it's generally a challenge also in the case of the barium tagging, is that it's not a background-free process, the barium tagging. So although it helps to reject other backgrounds, necessarily a good idea if you want to expand to the next generation.
Can I pick on that? Sorry, I don't get it. You drink the xenon, or you recirculate the liquid?
You recirculate
like the liquid that you extract with xenon.
Yeah.
So you don't know whether the xenon that you have came from your candidate event?
You could, if you set up the flow conditions right. Yeah? Yep. Yeah. It's tricky, but you could. Yeah.
No, but okay, so what's the, you may not need that, right? If you can recirculate the liquid on a time scale that is fast compared to the time scale of background events and the original features, then you can still have the coincidence requirement.
Yeah.
But
that's all you need.
But that's
the special
information.
Why is that?
Don't circulate that fast.
Yeah. No, it's not so
good. No, wait, how many signal candidates are you going to have? Right, of course. But what's your rate?
Several hertz.
In your energy range of interest.
Oh, yeah, no, not in the energy range, but they make daughters of the other. Right, so so if you pick those up by accident, right, you have to then figure out if it came from this place with the right energy,